Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Ariel Helwani, and Ariel has been covering mixed martial arts professionally since 2006. He is the reigning five-time World MMA Journalist of the Year Award winner, and he is a graduate of Syracuse University's esteemed SI Newhouse School of Public Communications, which we do talk about. And in this conversation, I got to interview the interviewer. I've respected Ariel so much over the years for his ability to navigate a situation that's been very difficult to navigate. And that is the situation with him in the UFC, where the UFC didn't like him for reasons unclear. But what I loved in this conversation was Ariel's ability to deliver candid, honest answers about his own personal well-being, his time at ESPN, how he's moved on, what makes him happy, and I got a real appreciation for what makes Ariel such a likable character for so many. He's got over 1 million followers on Instagram, 1 million on Twitter. He is the go-to guy in the world of MMA, the world of UFC. I'm a big UFC fan myself, so this was great to hear behind the scenes about somebody who has dominated that field. So without further ado, this is my episode with Ariel Helwani. Oh, and before we get to it, it would mean the world to me if you shared this with at least one person who you think would enjoy it as well. That's all for me. Let's get into it with Ariel Helwani.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Ariel Helwani, it is an absolute pleasure to have you here. I started my career as a... when I was 14... 15 years old, I started a Knicks blog, and my whole dream was to get to Syracuse and to go to Newhouse. And so I'm very familiar with the journey of a sports reporter, and I'm really grateful because I followed your career for a long time, and I'm honored that you would take the time here today to talk about your life.
Yeah, my pleasure. Did you go to Syracuse?
No, I didn't. It was kind of a dream that fell off pretty quickly, but I have a lot of respect for the path that you've taken in life, and I'm aware of Syracuse in general just being the powerhouse of sports journalism and journalism program in general.
I appreciate it, man. Well, great to be here. Thanks for bearing with me, and I'm happy we're able to do this.
Hell yeah. So take me through starting at HBO Sports and being an intern there. I assume that the Syracuse Newhouse perspective it helped you that you went to Newhouse, but how did you get the HBO Sports internship, and how was that foundational to your career, if at all?
Well, so there's this database, which I'm assuming all these other schools have, but it's, like this, when I was at Syracuse back in 01, 02, 03, 04, there was this computer that you could go to and type in a name, an industry, a network, where you'd want to reach out to these people and you know, work for them, get an internship. So junior year going into senior year, it was time to start working and trying to make some connections in the business. So I remember printing out like 50 different contacts of people that I could potentially talk to, work for, work with, etc. Didn't hear back from a lot of people. In fact, one person who actually called me, I'll never forget, I don't know if you're familiar with him, is Adam Schein, who has developed into, you know, quite the radio/host as well, radio host, but also TV host. I thought that was really cool. I remember he was filling his car with gas when he called me, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. So you get a lot of contacts, and it's a lot of people who are from Newhouse, who went to Newhouse, so it's alumni stuff. And I was a big combat sports fan, so I remember typing in HBO. Why was I a combat sports fan?
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up loving sports. I grew up loving basketball, baseball, football, hockey. But I also love the pageantry of combat sports. I love the characters. I love the buildup. I love all that stuff that goes into fighting. Mano y mano, who's the better man, the storylines, the beef. Grew up a big pro wrestling fan, a big boxing fan, all that stuff. And I remember just kind of typing in HBO Sports because HBO was the home of boxing at the time. They were the leaders in boxing. So I got like an info at HBO email address. I sent them an email, and amazingly, they wrote me back, and we had an interview, and they gave me an internship in the summer of 2003. And then when I graduated in 2004, they offered me a deal to come back and work in their documentary department, which was really cool for a year. And that's how the whole journey started.
When did you have the idea that you wanted to be the face of the UFC or the face of MMA? When people thought of MMA, they wanted to think of your name. When did that come into the picture?
Well, from a media standpoint, I didn't want to be a fighter or anything like that.
Of course.
So I grew up watching all this stuff, and I grew up watching, like, you know, when UFC 1 happened, I was 11. So I was familiar with it, and, you know, just watched it and tried to see as many pay-per-views as possible. It was hard to get and follow because the internet was still in its infancy and all that. And I remember getting to Syracuse, and for the first time being around people who had the same dream that I did, which was essentially, you know, they all wanted to be the next baseball, basketball, football guy. And I said to my parents, maybe a month or two into Syracuse, you know, like, everyone here wants to be the same thing, and I don't like being the same thing, and I really love the fight game, and there's this sport called mixed martial arts and this league called the UFC, this organization called the UFC, and there's no one really covering it in a professional manner, in a manner which, you know, you would see in other sports, like, you know, basketball reporters, baseball reporters, etc. And I want to be that guy. You know, there's no Howard Cosell. There's no Max Kellerman. And so, you know what? I'm going to make an MMA radio show, and I'm going to try to, you know, go down this path. While everyone's going down this path, I'll go down this path, and maybe I'll establish myself down this path, and at some point I could jump over to that world as well. So it was really back in 2001 when I had this this idea.
Wow. And so you've been looking at and watching fights for 20 years at least, probably more.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you think that's impacted your mind?
My mind, like, as a human being?
Yeah, you've probably witnessed. I heard Joe Rogan say one time that he's probably seen and been live for more fights and seen more people knocked out than anyone in history, possibly. And you've watched all those fights as well. So it's like, how do you think that's impacted yourself to watch so many fights?
It's a great question. I think you're obviously desensitized to it, right? You show someone MMA or boxing for the first time and they're like, what the F? You know, some people are squeamish. Some people don't like the blood. Some people don't like this and that. I've completely become desensitized to it. What I've become hypersensitive to is, you know, how the sausage is made and, you know, fighter pay and fighter health and safety and, you know, what happens to fighters when they retire and they can't, you know, fight anymore and they can't be on the big stage and they can't be on TV and all that stuff. That's the stuff that after watching fights, like, I don't get squeamish when I see someone get knocked out. I don't get squeamish when I see someone, you know, lose via armbar or get choked out. But I am constantly thinking about, like, what's this person's future and how this loss will affect their future and do they have enough money and have they made enough money and do they get the respect that they deserve from their promoters and stuff like that. So I think I didn't think about those things when I started, and now I'm thinking about them all the time. And I remember when I was a lot younger, I read a book about Howard Cosell. And, you know, Howard Cosell was a legend and the voice of boxing for many years, ABC, Wide World of Sports, and Monday Night Football and all that stuff. And I remember reading that at the end of his illustrious career and life, he actually didn't watch boxing anymore and didn't like boxing because he saw what it did to his friend Muhammad Ali and other fighters that, you know, he covered. And that always stuck with me. And I always wondered if that was going to happen to me as well, if I would feel differently about the sport that, you know, I watch so often, care about. It hasn't happened yet, but I can now totally understand how it could happen. And I hope it doesn't happen, but I completely sympathize with them, because once you start to like grow with guys and see what happens to them after they retire, you start to feel a little differently about it all.
That's what you were worried about with leaving ESPN, where you were saying to yourself, am I even going to be able to watch ESPN again?
Yeah, so. Because you're bitter, you feel a certain way. I will say I have no problem watching the games. I don't avoid watching the programming, like the shows, because I feel a certain way. It's just like when you're not living in their orbit, it's not top of mind. I don't think people are watching SportsCenter and things like that as much as they did 20 years ago, because there's the internet, there's phones, there's Instagram, Twitter, all this stuff, social media. When you're living in that world, that's always on your mind. Oh, we need you on SportsCenter. We need you on GetUp. And you're thinking like, oh, everyone's watching this. But that's not really the case. So I'm happy that I'm able to still watch the NBA or the NFL or baseball or hockey on ESPN, and that I don't feel bad. And in fact, my feelings towards ESPN are I'm very grateful to finally have gotten the opportunity. I'm grateful for the experience, and I'm also grateful that, you know, I was able to leave and go on to do other things.
How do you find that feeling of gratitude?
I mean, I'm just, I don't have any bitterness in my heart. I don't feel bitter towards them. I don't feel like I was wronged. Of course, I would be lying if I said like, oh, when I showed up there, I thought I would, you know, leave after 3 years. No, you go somewhere and you think it's going to last 20 years. But I kind of had a feeling, if I'm being honest early on, that this isn't going to last forever, just given the landscape and given the relationship with the UFC. And so I just tried to make the most of it. And what I didn't want was by the end of my time there, I would have no options, no other places to go. As it turns out, I had an abundance of options, and I was very grateful. And I'm not silly enough to believe that being now a former ESPN employee makes people view you in a different way. So that's why I'm grateful. I'm grateful because they gave me the rub, they gave me the platform, they gave me the opportunities. I took them. They didn't have to put me on basketball. They didn't have to give me E60. They didn't have to give. There are a lot of great people who work there. I don't really have a beef with them. I mean, they offered me a deal. I didn't love the deal. I went elsewhere. I found, and we shook hands and left. And so I think that sometimes when I'm on shows and I'm talking about X, Y, and Z, people think that it's sour grapes or this and that. There aren't any sour grapes. And most of my issues are really with the UFC, because the UFC tried to flex. But that's nothing new, and I expected all of that.
How do you deal with the situation of covering a sport where the organization doesn't make you feel welcome?
That's a great question. I definitely have felt a certain way about that. It's like you know, you devote your whole life, your career to this, and like the top league that you're talking about almost, you know, 24/7 doesn't want you around, doesn't like you, doesn't want to help you, doesn't want to give you access. That took a while to come to terms with. It's become a lot easier for me now that I don't really go to the events. So I don't have to feel that sort of unwelcome nature. I don't have to feel uncomfortable. I don't have to feel any of that. So I think it's a lot better now. I'm still covering the sport. I talk to the fighters. They're able to come on the show, all that stuff. And ultimately, when you boil it down to the fact that it's really just one guy who doesn't like me, who just happens to have a lot of power. It's not the whole I know there are people in the organization who like me and respect me and I have a good relationship. It's just the one guy who happens to be the most important guy. And so I don't view it as the sport or the league. It's just, hey, crap happens. One guy doesn't like you. He has a lot of power and you have to deal with that.
Yeah. And speaking about people liking you, though, it's crazy because it seems to me, looking from the outside in, how many fighters actually you have a relationship with and who look at you like a friend who you're able to go back and forth with. And, you know, why do you think you've been able to create such friendships in that environment where, you know, one guy doesn't necessarily like you with a lot of power, but you've been able to still make friendships? How do you think that's happened exactly?
I think it's because I'm respectful towards them. I'm trustworthy. I've never broken their trust. I've never, you know, they've never told me something and then I went out and reported when they told me it was off the record, you know, that sort of thing. That goes a long way. You break that trust once, it's very hard to get it back and to build it back up. And so, yeah, I'm very thankful for that. You know, I always see people be like, oh, everyone hates you, you have so many enemies. The problem is, it's like when people don't like you, it becomes very pronounced, and especially when it's like one really powerful individual. But, you know, I started covering MMA professionally, if we don't want to count the Syracuse days, 2006. And, I mean, think about how many fighters have come through not only the UFC, but, you know, Bellator and Elite XC and Strikeforce and Pride and Ryzen and all these places, right? And like you could count the quote unquote beefs and haters on one hand. I mean, it's like thousands of fighters that I've interacted with at this point. So I'm very proud of that. And no one can ever say that I broke their trust. No one can ever say that they told me something in confidence and I went out and reported it. No one could say that I reported something wrong about them. So I think that because of all of that, I've been able to maintain these great relationships. And the fighters know that, look, if you want to call me biased in any sort of way, yeah, maybe I'm a little biased in the fact that I want the fighters to be treated well. I want the fighters to get what they are owed. I want them to have security. I want them to get paid. And I think that, and I don't do that to like suck up or curry favor. I think they respect that. I think that they're, you know, they're appreciative of that. And so I think that's part of the reason why we've been able to have these relationships.
Yeah. And another thing that I noticed is when doing research for this is how you figure out how everybody likes to be communicated with. And I thought that was such a subtle nuance where you know that some people prefer iMessage, some people prefer WhatsApp, yeah. Some people prefer Instagram DM. And that level of that attention to detail is so underrated in a world where things get left to chance. What makes you like that?
Man, I think I'm a lot obsessive compulsive. I've always had OCD. Like, I mean, even when I was a kid, I would walk over like a crack in the sidewalk and I would have to go back and walk over it again. I mean, even talking about it makes me feel a certain way. So I'm not a control freak. I don't in that regard, but like when it comes to the work, I obsess over it. And I think that not letting, you know, I've booked every guest in the history of the show. Like right now we're taping this on a Friday and I appreciate the questions because I appreciate how perceptive you are and these aren't the typical questions that you get. So thank you. But like it's Friday and I'm like, all right, who do I have on Monday and how am I going to reach out to them and book them and who should I get? And my mind is constantly working and I wouldn't necessarily think that's like the healthiest thing in the world. It's good to have some balance, but it's just like I'm constantly thinking about it, constantly thinking about how I can raise the bar and be better than last week and give people an entertaining show. It's just my nature. I guess it's because I love it so much and I care about it so much that, you know, I want to do the best and I want to be on top of the game and know if I want to book this guy, I have to go this route and reach out to this person on this platform. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. I'm weird. I can't tell you anything about the stock market. I don't keep up with anything else. I pretty much just follow this and, you know, a little bit of the Bills and Knicks and my vices and that's pretty much, I don't watch shows. I'm not a very complex individual in that regard. I don't have a lot of distractions. The best thing is I have kids and I have a wife and I'm not sitting at home, you know, on my phone 24/7 refreshing Twitter and Instagram. I have balance and perspective because I am a father and a husband. And I think that's actually helped me a lot throughout my life.
You mentioned how you want to become better every week and your aim is to make the show better. What and how do you define a better show? How do you know? Because this is a creative pursuit, right? Talking to people, interviewing people. Is it by the amount of people who listen or watch? Is it by your own feeling about your own performance? How do you determine what better actually is?
Yeah, it's the latter. Like I actually, you know, we were supposed to do this earlier and then an interview came my way and so we had to reschedule. And I hated the interview. I hated it. And it's going to like ruin my day. I hated it for myself. I hated my performance. I didn't like the questions and I missed certain things and my head wasn't there. And so I've never left the show, any show, and been like, you freaking nailed that. You nailed that. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. but that continuously like serves as my engine to try to be better, to try to be better, to try to be more entertaining. And of course, you want more views, you want more this, but it's really about like my own performance. I think I'm the best. I think I'm the best interviewer in sports. I'm not talking MMA. I'm not talking combat sports. I think I'm the best. And I don't think I get the credit that I deserve. And so all these things are like in my mind, and you're not the best. You suck today. And you start like fighting with yourself. So again, I'm not advocating to be this way. It's just the way I am. And of course, it probably helps you because you're competitive. And it, like I said, it serves as an engine. And I'm just very critical of my work. And I expect a lot of myself. And again, I think all of this has helped me. At some point, I would love to be content and be like, man, you actually really nailed that. That was great. But that day hasn't come just yet.
What happens on before the days when you perform better?
What happens when I perform better? I mean,
What happens before?
Nothing. There's no rhyme or reason. Like I am somewhat superstitious. So like if I have what I think is a pretty good show, I try to like recreate what I did that day. Recreate what I ate that day. And again, not advocating for this type of lifestyle, but it's like, oh, did I exercise in the morning? Maybe that cleared my head, or did I have a good night's sleep? And I definitely think all these things help, by the way, but like, did I eat a good breakfast or something, you know? But ultimately, it's like, if you're locked in, if you're prepared, you know, it's going to happen. Like, you know, I don't like stumbling. I don't like stuttering and all that stuff, but I honestly think it's impossible to like deliver the perfect show or the perfect interview, but I keep striving for that. And then I'll listen to other people, I'm like, man, that's really good, or you know, did I not talk into the mic the right way, all this crap. Like one thing about, you know, doing these this stuff from home, sometimes it's like I'm really insane about audio quality and video quality and how I look and all that stuff. Is the light shining the right way? And when you're in a studio, you don't really worry, like there's people whose job, but here, you know, pandemic, we all had to do it sort of ourselves. And I don't love the way it sounds all the time when I'm doing stuff from home. Now, luckily when I'm doing MMA Hour, I'm in a studio, but when I'm doing other stuff from home, I don't love the way it sounds or the way it looks. So that's all like part of the OCD, and I've bought like 4 different mics and I've changed things and, you know.
On the topic of, you know, how you're so obsessive about every detail, I'm curious how therapy has helped you with that, if at all.
It hasn't helped me with that. It's helped me with anxiety, and it's helped me really, like, the reason why I went to see a therapist was because I wasn't happy at ESPN. I knew the end was near. I needed to figure out where I wanted to go and how I was going to maneuver through all of this. And I think part of it was, you know, pandemic and travel and all that. And like, I, you know, I'm a bit of a germaphobe, and I don't know, like all this stuff has become heightened, right? We're talking about germs and viruses all freaking day long. It messes with your head. And it's something that I've wanted to do for a long time. I did it once when I was in Syracuse because I was very unhappy there and I didn't like it. You know, like if you don't mesh with the person that you're talking to, it becomes very tough. And so I was like, man, I need to do this. It was February of last year. I really need to do this. I don't feel well. I don't feel happy. I felt like my head was like cloudy and I needed to open it up and I needed to talk to someone who was not like a family member, like someone who would just listen to me and would then offer advice and would question me on certain things. And honestly, I don't know if I leave ESPN if I don't do that. I think I stay there probably, you know, out of spite. And that's obviously not a healthy thing to do. So yeah, everyone has different reasons why they need to talk to someone. But I would just advocate, if you feel like you do, like, it could only be helpful. And of course, you know, you may meet someone that you don't mesh with. You may have to look around. But if you can find the right person, it can be very advantageous.
What do you think separates a good therapist from a great therapist?
It's kind of like what makes like a good interviewer and a
great interviewer, right? Someone who listens, someone who asks the proper questions, the proper follow-ups, the proper, you know, like someone who's like sort of challenging you, right? Because it's not just listen, I understand. But then they can ask certain things that make you think a certain way. And that will change your mind and your perception and your feelings. So I'm not an expert when it comes to, luckily, when I reached out to someone, I liked that person and I still talk to them every week. Even though like the conversation is different now, right? I left, I figured it out. I'm happier, much happier, infinitely happier. So it's like, okay, it worked, but now there's other things that we can talk about. And maybe I won't need, maybe I'll come to a point where I'm like, you know what? Okay, we're good. You know, I'm content. But for now it's still been less than a year and I feel like it's beneficial and it's, you know, it's helpful to become a better person, to become a better father, to become a better husband, to become a better son. I feel like it has made me a better human being, not just a better media guy, interviewer, whatever. So, what I like about the person I talk to is, you know, asking follow-ups, listening, like I believe she's actually listening to me. And that's the same thing that you want out of a good interview, right? Someone who listens, who asks, you know, the proper questions, who will ask follow-ups and all that stuff. So there's actually a few times where like I'll say something and then, you know, she'll respond with something and then I'll be like, that's a great follow-up. Like that's something that I feel like I would do, or at least I would appreciate if someone did that to me in an interview. So there's a lot of similarities there.
Definitely. You know, we mentioned before about how you've seen so many violent exchanges in MMA, but you also have dealt with being in the media for so long with so much noise coming at you. You've tweeted over 160,000 times just yourself. And that's an absurd stat.
That's stupid.
But think about all the inputs that had to come in for you to then talk or retweet or whatever about those inputs themselves. So how do you think keeping up with the news, keeping up with Twitter for so long has impacted your mental?
Oh, bad. It's bad. Like I'd love to be on Twitter less. Twitter has been great for my career. I mean, I remember when I started it. I remember when someone introduced me to it. I remember when I had like 2,000 followers. I remember having 4,000 followers at UFC 112 in Abu Dhabi, and I was the only North American person there, and I was live tweeting the press conference, and overnight I got 1,000, and I was like, holy crap, I got 1,000 new followers. That's insane. And so I've always been very, you know, I guess you could say like aggressive on Twitter, in not aggressive in terms of like arguing with people, but like getting information out and all that stuff. And there's a value to it. Like I think people see, oh, you have X amount of followers. There's definitely a value to that. I've tried for the most part to not abuse Twitter, in that I try not to tweet about like everything under the sun. I was very strict about that for like a good portion of my career, where I wouldn't talk about anything other than MMA because I knew people were just there to see my MMA stuff. Now I've obviously loosened the reins on that. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. That's cool. No, you know, no offense taken. But I hate the fact that, you know, someone said this to me last week, even like, you know, your brain is not a hotel. People can't just come in and check in and sit on the couch and put their feet up. And you're allowing sometimes people to do that when they're trolling and stuff like that. And so I've become better at not reading the comments and engaging and stuff like that, because it's just a slippery slope and nothing good comes of it. There's a great tab if you are verified, where it's just like verified people replying to you. And that tab tends to be a lot more civil than the other BS. So, you know, I never was one to like go on message boards and read what everyone was saying. And the tricky thing about Twitter is it's like right on your phone and it comes right to you. And it's like everyone's damn opinion. And it's people who are trying to get a rise out of you and ruin your day and ruin your mental state. And it's not healthy. It's definitely not healthy. So that's one of my, you know, goals, is to use it less, like not use it less in terms of sharing information or sharing my work, but just like stop reading everything. It's okay if you're not on top of every single thing, and use it to your advantage and then walk away.
How do you determine when's the right time to fight an argument that somebody's coming at you, or just let it be?
I've, for the most part, I've been very good, I think, throughout my career on Twitter, my life on Twitter, whatever, using Twitter. For the most part, I think I've been very good about not engaging with that stuff. There used to be a time where I felt like I needed to reply to everyone. Then I stopped. And I try not to – I hate these Twitter beefs, these Twitter battles. It's all bullshit. But I think what happened was when I was at ESPN for 3 years, I felt a little suffocated. And I was told so many times never to reply, never to engage. And then when I left, I was like, you know, I exploded a little bit. And that's like all the Hiawani stuff and all that. So I'm definitely not going to make a habit out of it. And I'm not looking for fights. I'm not trying to poke the bear, whoever that may be. But if someone is incessantly going after me, I'm not going to stand down anymore. And I'm not going to take the high road and just let them do that. I used to be like against blocking and muting and stuff like that. The mute is a great thing because you you don't, you know, they don't know that they're muted, right? So they just keep talking to you. But now I don't care. If you're really annoying me, I'll block you. I don't want to give people the satisfaction, so I'll go to mute first. But I just, you know, it's none of it is real. And people act weird and people act a certain way. And they would never say the vast majority of these things in person. So I just, I try to keep that in mind and not let it get to me as much.
Yeah, it's entertaining, but it's not, you can't get too involved with that stuff. But before I let you go, I'd love to ask, what's one thing you could do to make 2022 the happiest year of your life?
Wow, what a question. And by the way, great questions, man. Really good and very insightful, and I appreciate it. You do great. Number one, like the first thing that comes to mind and the thing that I'm always concerned with is health, right? So like at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what's going on in your job, this, that, like as long as everyone's healthy, to me, everyone's happy, right? You're not going to the hospital. You're not, you know, my parents are healthy. My siblings are healthy. My kids are healthy. My wife is healthy. My dog is healthy. Like that's all that really matters to me, my friends. And, you know, this is an interesting year for me because I'm turning 40 in July, and that blows my mind. You become a little reflective when you hit milestones like that. And I'm extremely appreciative of where I'm at. If you would have told me when I was 20 that this would be my life, that I'd be doing this for a living, that I would have these kids and this wife and, you know, live in this house, like I would have taken that blindly. So I just, you know, I just want to not take everything so seriously. Don't take the job so seriously. Don't let them get to you. Just, you know, do the work, be happy, be proud of it, and live in the moment. Appreciate your kids, appreciate your family. Don't let the work affect your family life. You know, like when it's time to shut off, it's time to shut off. And there's definitely like some career things that I want to accomplish as well. But I'm just very grateful right now that everything turned out the way it did. I feel like I'm in a constant state of gratitude. I want to be healthy. I want to be a little more active with exercise and always get in better shape and all this stuff. But overall, like if things can continue, I pray to God that it can continue in terms of health and my family. Like I've really nothing to complain about. I am very, very grateful. Like there's nothing I want more of. There's nothing I need more of. I just want this. If everything could stay the same, I'll be a very happy man.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to come to a close. Ariel, I really appreciate your answers, your honesty here, but also the work you've done. It's incredible. I enjoy it. I take notes as a fellow interviewer myself. I love MMA. I love UFC. And you are the gold standard from that perspective and in sports in general. So thank you for taking the time. Thanks, man. Being you. And keep crushing it. We'll put all your social links below.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. You do great. You actually remind me a little bit of myself, if I'm being honest. Your tone and your questions. So I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I wish you the best. And keep in touch, my man.
Yes, sir. Have a great one.
All right.
Peace.
Take care.
That was Ariel Helwani, and what a nice guy. The comparison to himself and me at the end, I mean, he's a 15-year veteran in journalism, so I'm incredibly honored and grateful for those kind words. Before you go, would love for you to hop on Twitter right now and let me know what you thought about this 30-minute episode. Did you enjoy it? Did you wish this episode went an hour? Did you wish it went an hour and a half? I'm curious your perspective, your thoughts. Let me know on Twitter. And if you enjoyed these 35 minutes, share it with a friend. Share it on social media. Let other people know who might enjoy this type of interview, who might enjoy this type of content. So thank you for listening. I'm incredibly grateful for it. And I hope you have a wonderful day. I will see you in the next episode. Peace.